Beautiful sight right there. Beautiful sight. Hey, so glad to have Silveria with us. Silveria was actually in a small group that me and Mandy were leading back when we were in seminary that was so transformational. If you've been in any refresh group with us, we've talked about that group and really what God did in that season, in that group, not just through Silveria, but also through him, was so transformative that was where we were like, we are so convinced in the power of small groups and stuff like that. So there you go. Get to put a face with a name. But anyway, today we're continuing in our series called Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And it's been a lot of fun tracking through this baseball series. And we're talking about big lessons of life and big lessons of faith that really come from the great American pastime of baseball. And just to get us started this morning, before we jump in, let me start with a little bit of trivia for you. Are you ready for some baseball trivia? All right, here we go. These are kind of a do you know, do you remember? But do you remember, how many of you remember the baseball player Francisco Cabrera? Anybody remember him? Yeah, we reference him a little bit. Yes, some of you who are Pirates fans don't want to remember him. I understand. Now here's a hard one. I had nobody in the first service that remembered this guy. How many of you remember the baseball player named Jerry Willard? Anybody remember Jerry Willard? Yeah, we got one. Remembers Jerry Willard. Yeah. Well, hold those names, hold that thought, and we're going to be talking about today. I think you're going to see that you've got some similarities to a couple of these baseball players. So today, the theme of the message is the bottom of the ninth. Bottom of the ninth. Now, when I was growing up, back on Waterport Way, that was the street where we were growing up, we would always, like, I would rehearse these bottom of the ninth moments in the cul-de-sac. As I was getting ready to play baseball, it was usually Todd Franklin was there, who's at this church, a few of my siblings, and we'd be playing with a tennis ball, either home run derby or something. I would just think in my head, it's the bottom of the ninth. There's two outs, you know, runners on base. If you get a hit, your team wins. And if you don't, you know, you better start walking back home, you know. And so I would just rehearse these moments because the bottom of the ninth, for those of you who are baseball fans, you know, if you're in the bottom of the ninth and you're batting in the bottom of the ninth, it is go time. If you're in the bottom of the ninth, it usually means that your team is either behind in some kind of way or at least not ahead. They're tied at the very best. And the bottom of the ninth is very symbolic. Because the bottom of the ninth means that you're up to bat, or your team's up to bat, and you've got one more chance. This is like your last chance for a comeback. And so just to kind of make the connection to us today, let me ask you this question. How many of you in your life, or have you ever felt, I'll say it like this, have you ever felt behind in an area of your life? Have you ever felt behind? Anybody ever felt behind in an area of your life? In fact, all of us are probably like, yeah. Some of us are like, yeah, that's my life all the time. I'm always behind, right? In fact, for some of us, it may be just a time thing, like we're running behind, whether it's like we're rushing into church, you know, and diving through the coffee area in order to get your kids checked in and everything, whatever. Maybe it's that. But for so many of us, we can look at like our to-do list. And it's like we're over here and there's a scoreboard and we're not doing too well. And then our to-do list keeps going up and up and up and up. And we feel like no matter how hard we work, we're always behind. There's always more stuff to do. But I would imagine, I think for so many of us, that we know that feeling too well of being behind in a lot more important areas than just our schedule and our to-do list. Some of us know that truth about maybe feeling behind. Maybe you're in a season of life, you've been there, maybe you're there right now, where you maybe have felt behind, let's say, financially. And maybe it's not like the bottom of the ninth, but maybe it's like the bottom of the third, you know? It's the bottom of the sixth, and you know, like, man, we need to make some kind of comeback. Maybe for you, it's been relationally. Like, you know what it feels like to feel behind in a relationship in your life, whether it's, you know, whether it's somebody that's in your family, you know? Like you say, pass the gravy at Thanksgiving and a fight breaks out, right? You know, it's like, whoa, something was happening before all this, right? Or maybe it's with a coworker. Like, you know, just things are kind of rocky, not the way you would want it to be. Many of you are probably thinking of a name right now of that coworker, right? Or maybe we felt behind. Maybe we felt behind with the person that we're married to at times. Or maybe the person we used to be married to, we felt behind. Or maybe when it comes to a relationship with our kids, like our son or our daughter, like, you know, the relationship that we want to have is just, we're kind of behind where we'd like to be. And so, you know, we know that feeling. Or maybe when it comes to our career, so many of us have felt like we're behind, you know, like we get passed up for an opportunity. Or we had this dream that we always had, like we wanted to be here at this time, but instead we're kind of in this season where we're still all the way back here. Or maybe it's a dream that we've had, this dream that we feel like maybe God put on our life that's either dead or so far behind that it feels like it's dying, a death of a dream. Or maybe for so many of us, we know people in our lives who are behind when it comes to our health or physically in some kind of way. And we know those moments, and maybe we've been there. And so the thing is like when we face moments like that, when we face bottom of the ninth moments in our lives, here's the emotion that really comes out of all of us. It's this. We feel like we're down and out. We feel like we're down and out. No matter what we're going through, we feel like we're down and out. And so in those moments, it's one of those things where, did you know that in the game of baseball, 95% of the time, if you were the one batting in the bottom of the ninth inning, 95% of the time you lose the game. That's a bad stat, right? I mean, you can put your rally cap on, you can cheer as hard as you want, but statistics say that 95% of the teams that are batting means they're behind in the ninth inning, they lose the game. Batting behind in the ninth inning. And so here's the thing. The bottom of the ninth means that usually you fail, usually you lose, the odds are against you. And so in those bottom of the ninth moments, it's easy to feel like there is just no hope. Like, you know, there's no hope. But here's the thing. The game of baseball reminds us that when we get to the bottom of the ninth in our lives, the game of baseball reminds us that you may be down, but you're not out. You may be down, the odds may be against you, but you're not out. There's still hope. And so, you know, that's really a theme in the game of baseball, but it's a theme all throughout the Bible. You know, I shared in week one about one of the greatest bottom of the ninth baseball moments of all time, and of course it's with the Atlanta Braves. Hallelujah, right? But I'm going to keep bringing it up a few more times. No, but in 1992, the National League Championship Series was going on. The Atlanta Braves versus the Pittsburgh Pirates. It's one of the greatest Braves moments of all time. It was Game 7. And the winner goes to the World Series. Like, whoever wins, like, you go to the World Series. And the Phillies, or not Phillies, that's like our enemy now, but the Pittsburgh Pirates, they had some incredible players. Barry Bonds was one of them. Maybe he took steroids, Barry Bonds. Like, you know, and he was incredible even then. Like, you didn't need that stuff. You were the best. He was incredible. So they had all these awesome players, but they were ahead 2-0. So the Braves were behind, and it's the bottom of the ninth. And in the middle of this bottom of the ninth, down 2-0, this little unknown Braves player steps up to bat, and his name was, trivia question, Francisco Cabrera. Let's check out the scene one more time.
He hacked at the 2-0, now the 2-1. Line drive and a base hit! Just as the score of the tying run, Green to the plate! And he is saved at the plate! The Braves go to the World Series!
So what most people forget, what most people don't realize in that scene is that Francisco Cabrera is a household name in Atlanta. But what most of us forget is that he was actually this incredible underdog when he came up to bat. In fact, leading up to that moment, Francisco Cabrera had only batted 10 times the entire season. That's like not the guy you want up. He'd batted 10 times. And out of those 10 times, he had failed more than 70% of the time. Not the guy you want up, right? And not only that, but the same pitcher he's about to face in the bottom of the ninth with 2-0 losing is the same pitcher that he had failed against earlier in the series. So one of the 10 at-bats, same guy he's facing. And so the odds are against him. And so when the pitcher spot came up, Bobby Cox looks down the bench and he decides to put in this underdog player in Game 7 of the World Series. And I love this moment. I love seeing the result of that. It's a great lesson for us. Because it's one of those things where Francisco Cabrera didn't let his underdog status overpower him. He didn't let his past failures, like, man, I'm like 0 for, you know, whatever against this guy. He didn't let his past failures define him. And he didn't let the enormity of the difficult circumstance around him distract him from the mission ahead. And so when it comes to our lives, I just kind of wonder, when it comes to our lives in the bottom of the ninth moments, how many times in our lives, how many times in our lives do we allow our past failures define us? How many times do we let maybe the difficult circumstances around us dictate kind of really what defines us and defines that moment more than God? And so here's the thing. The truth is, in those bottom of the ninth moments, your Heavenly Father specializes in comeback moments. In the bottom of the ninth, your Heavenly Father specializes in coming through and bringing turnaround stories. In fact, all throughout the Bible, there's all these turnaround stories, comeback moments in the bottom of the ninth. I think of all sorts of people in the Bible. The first one that comes to mind is Daniel. Daniel in the lion's den. You may remember that story. Not a kid's story. He's thrown into a lion's den, right? He's thrown into a lion's den for having faith in God, and they come back to check on him the next day. You know, he should be dead, and he's just chilling out with the lions, and God had, who's roaring like a lion, had stopped the mouth of the lions, and Daniel was saved. God saved him in the bottom of the ninth. Then I think of a person like Moses. Moses had all these, tons of bottom of the ninth moments. The Red Sea, God bringing manna when they were in the desert. But the thing that comes to mind most is when Moses was a baby. When Moses was a baby, the Egyptian Pharaoh had commanded for people to kill every baby who was 2 years, every boy who was 2 years or under. And so Moses, of course, is in that category. And so his mother makes the gut-wrenching decision to put her baby, Moses, in a basket and to push him down the Nile River that was filled with alligators in hopes that maybe in the bottom of the ninth that God would come through. And sure enough, he's rescued from somebody in Pharaoh's family. Crazy. Bottom of the ninth, God came through. I think of Jonah. And if you're ever in the belly of a fish, like, it's the bottom of the ninth, If you're ever, stranded in the middle of the ocean, it's the bottom of the ninth. And we know that story. Like, even though he was running from God, God used a fish to save his life and to spit him out on sea so that he could go in the direction of God. And then we know, of course, in the New Testament, there's a lot of examples, but the biggest example is Jesus. It's Friday. He's dead. He's in a tomb. All hope is gone. But that was Friday, as Tony Campolo says. Sunday's coming, right? We know that he robbed the grave on Sunday. And so the truth is, God seems to have this habit of bringing comeback moments. He specializes in it. And so in the bottom of the ninth moments in our lives, we can have hope knowing that our Heavenly Father has the power to do the very same thing he did back then in our lives, in every area of our life. And so today we're going to look at one of the most powerful, one of the most popular bottom of the ninth moments in all the Bible. It's this comeback story, and it's found in the Old Testament in 1 Samuel chapter 17. If you have your Bible, smartphone, whatever you got, your scroll, if you brought that today, you can turn to that. The words are also going to be on the screen. And if you don't have a Bible, we've got free ones out on the coffee table. So, but anyway, let me set it up before we read it. It's this encounter that happens between, this battle that happens really between the people of God, who are the Israelites, and the people who are not of God, the Philistines. And they have this awful history of just like always going into battle with each other. They hated each other. To put it in baseball terms, it would have been like the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox. You know, they hated each other. If you've ever seen those series, they like throw balls at each other and stuff, you know? Like, and if somebody does it, they do it again, you know? And so, they hated each other so badly. You can decide out in New York or Boston who's the people of God and who's not. You make the call. But here's the thing. The Philistines were the enemies of God. They hated the people of God. They wanted to eliminate them. And so they would go into battle with God's people so many times. A lot of time it was over land. Like, I want to take your land. I want to take your people. But oftentimes it was to show whose God is bigger, whose God is more powerful, and who's the real God in the land. And so the Philistines were very well trained. They were very battle tested. They had this huge army. And the book of Judges in chapter 13, it tells us that the Philistine army had actually dominated God's people back in the time of Samson. And so this was like the past, all that they knew is it would have been easy for the Israelites to let their past failures dictate what happens in the future. Like, we failed before, and here they are again. Oh, no, we've got no hope. But I want you to check out what happens, 1 Samuel chapter 3, or chapter 17, verse 3. It says this: the Philistines occupied one hill, and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. You don't want to fight in the valley. You don't want to send troops in the valley. Because what happens if everybody's on a hill and you're in the valley? That's not the place you want to be. Here's what it says. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul?" In other words, who do you guys think you are? You are overmatched. He says, "Choose a man and have him come down to me," basically in the valley. "If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But," and he probably laughs here, "but if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. You can imagine why. It's the bottom of the ninth. And what's it's easy when we get to, like, we hear this story, David and Goliath, and many of us have grown up with this story and we know how it ends. But I want you to just pay attention to this, because it's easy when you know how a story ends to know, well, everything's going to be okay. You should just trust God. But for many of us, that's not the moments that we're in. I want us to sit in this story and sit in the moment of what they were facing. Because for the people of God, just like it for many of us in our lives and where we've been before, they're in the bottom of the ninth. They don't know how it's going to work out. They don't know how it's going to turn out. And all they have to turn to is the Lord. And so not only were they facing this enemy that they'd failed against before, like, we're never going to make it. But they also had these circumstances around them, this big, tall giant that seemed to be completely overpowering to them. And so one of the traditional ways that the Philistines would actually go into war, it's actually pretty financially frugal, is they would actually, instead of sending an entire army down in the valley, and God's people does that, they would select one person. They'd be like, they would select basically like a boxer, a challenger, a champion to go down in the valley, and one-on-one, mano a mano, they would fight each other. And whoever's representative won the battle, you know, then that side would win the battle. And so it helped save a lot of lives and it saved a lot of money, right? So they'd go down in the battle, and then whoever won was the one who won the battle, and it would demonstrate whose God was bigger. And so when you look at the stats of Goliath, it was overpowering. I mean, he's a guy where none of the Israelites matched up. In fact, Goliath was this war champion that stood about 9 feet, 9 inches tall, just under a basketball goal. Crazy. In fact, Malcolm Gladwell in his book writes a little bit about this. It's kind of like, that seems so far-fetched, but there's this disease that people have today. Let's see if I can say it right. It's acromelalgia or something like that. And basically, it's this disease of the pituitary gland. And Malcolm Gladwell said it's very possible he had this, where on his pituitary gland, there's maybe some kind of tumor or something that's hitting the pituitary gland that says, grow, 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 grow. And people have this today, and they grow really, really, really tall, and they don't live as long. But it's very possible Goliath had this. And so here he is, he's standing there, 9 feet, 9 inches tall. He's this ripped up, steroid-infused looking dude, you know, with a bad attitude. And he's standing there with all the armor you would expect. You know, he's covered with bronze armor that's weighing about 200 pounds, crazy. He's carrying this iron spear that weighs close to 15 pounds, and he's yelling at them, and he's taunting them, and he's taunting our God. And in the middle of that, if they were a baseball team, the people of God, if they were a baseball team, you can just imagine them in the dugout. Like, they'd be probably like not wanting to look at the coach, like, don't pick me, don't pick me, don't put me in, coach, you know? This is like the scene. This is what's going on. And so it says in verse 11 that on hearing the Philistines' words, Saul, who was the king, and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And isn't this how we feel when we face bottom of the ninth moments in our lives, when we face those giants in our lives? I mean, it's one of those things where I don't know what those giants are for you. I don't know what they are for you, but what I do know is that we all face moments or seasons where it feels like we are so over our head. And sometimes we don't know why. That's the question we often ask. Why, God, why are we going through this? We don't always know. Sometimes our giants that we face are a result of some bad decisions that we've made, or a series of bad decisions, and now we find ourselves in a giant of a situation that we got to get out of. bad decisions sometimes. But on the other hand, sometimes we're making all the right decisions. Sometimes it's because we are following God and we're following his will. And that giant is often an obstacle. We got to either go through or go around. In fact, this church being planted is one of the things we have seen giant after giant that we've had to say, we've got to go through this. We got to find a way around it. And God has come through. But there's also, we live in this world where we just know this. The world has been turned upside down because of sin and brokenness. And so we know that sometimes giants just happen. Giants just come, and there's not answers for them other than we live in a world that is broken and fractured and groaning to be restored, and it's waiting for us to be back with God and for everything to be restored. But until then, we face giants. And so in those moments, we don't always know, but no matter the reason, we all have this tendency. See, how you deal with it is what matters. We all have this tendency in the bottom of the ninth moments to zoom in on those things that we're facing. We zoom in on our past failures when we face those giants. And we think, I can't, I'm not, I failed before, there's no way, and all this stuff. We look at our past failures. And we also, at the same time, seem to zoom in on our present circumstances. And our present circumstances get so loud, screaming over us, that oftentimes we forget in the dark what God told us in the light. And so in those moments, it's one of those things where we're zooming in on our failures and on the enormity of our circumstances, and those giants start to seem so much bigger. They're already big, but they seem so much bigger when you're staring at them face to face. See, Goliath kept yelling, kicking up all sorts of dust, begging somebody to fight him, and the only one who had the faith to get out of the dugout, to step forward in faith, to conquer the giant, to step forward and attack him. It was a guy, this tiny, puny shepherd named David. And everybody's like, oh great, we are in trouble. In fact, just to build the case of how bad it was, David was actually King Saul's personal worship leader, which don't think like these guys that are like masculine rocking it up on stage up here. I want you to think about this, you know, harp player who come, you know, this harp player that's scrawny and probably wearing skinny jeans on the one side, right? And then on the other side, you have this steroid-infused giant that's like breathing fire, essentially, you know? And it's like, you just, if you're the people of God, you're like, we are so in trouble. Like, we have no chance. That 95% of the time you lose in the ninth inning, like, we're going to lose for sure, you know? But here's what happens. Here's what David says to God's people. Here's what he says, verse 32. It says this: David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." He's standing there in skinny jeans, and everybody's like, oh no. And here's what it says: Saul replied, "You are not able to go out against the Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant," talking about himself, "your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the bear, or paw of the lion, and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." And so Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Now he probably says this like, God, I hope that that's true, but he also probably says this as a prayer, like, Lord be with you, because, you know, bless your heart, you know? Like, we have no chance. The Lord be with you. Verse 38, it says, "Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic," that's manly, "he put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. He said, 'I cannot go in these,' he said to Saul, 'because I am not used to them.' So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 small stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine." Now, the thing that's crazy about this to me is that while everybody else was zooming in on the giant of the circumstance that was in front of them, while everybody else was thinking, "I can't, I'm not, we failed before," looking at their past failures, David was the only one who stepped forward in faith. And it wasn't because David was so strong. David stepped forward because he realized that God is on his side. And so it's one of those things where in the bottom of the ninth moment in our lives, and we're just in a season right now as a church where there are so many people going through bottom of the ninth moments in so many different ways right now. And one of the things that I have seen as a pastor is in bottom of the ninth moments, we all have a choice to make in those moments. That we can either use those moments and to turn toward God, to draw closer to God, to depend on God. Or in those moments, we can pull away from God and run away from him. And how you deal with those moments and who you draw your strength from defines the battle you face. In fact, in those moments, so many times we turn to God because we don't, like, God, this is bigger than me and I need your help. And we find that God comes through. But so many times we turn to people, start saying, why and where were you, God? And we run away from God in bitterness and frustration, wondering why God even brought it there. And the thing is how we deal with that, where we turn to defines those bottom of the ninth moments. And so in those moments, we all have to remember to stop zooming in on everything around us and our past failures, and instead to zoom out and to realize, number one, realize this first truth, is that God is with you and God is still working. No matter what you face in the bottom of the ninth moments, God is still with you and God is still working. But we oftentimes say, well, I don't feel like God is with me right now. Like with what I'm facing, like why, where, I don't feel like God's presence is with me. But just because you don't feel God's presence doesn't mean that the Lion of the tribe of Judah isn't there with you. He's right there with you. In fact, it's the same God who had the power to raise Jesus from the grave. He's with you. That's the truth. Never forget in the dark what God told you in the light. And so here's the thing, in the bottom of the ninth moments, we have to remember that no matter what we face, that God cares about us, and he cares also about the giant that's in front of us. And so the thing is, God doesn't promise that when we start following him, he just removes all the giants from our lives. In fact, Jesus even said in the New Testament, in this world, you will have trouble. It's like, thanks, Jesus. Like, why am I following you if we're going to still have trouble? But he said, but take heart. I've overcome the world. See, he came even the grave in order to get us out of ours. Nothing's too big for him. So he doesn't always promise to take away that giant, but God always promises to walk with you, to be with you with his power and strength as you face it. So here's how the story continues. Verse 41, here's some trash talk coming ahead. I love it as a sports guy. Here's what it says. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him. Like, what a wimp. You got to have a shield bearer in front of you. He kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. It's like, see this trash talk. Well, David's got a one-up in trash talk lessons. Here's what David says. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin. In other words, you come at me with depending on your own strength like everybody else. But he says, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. Talking about trash talk, he just one-upped this giant. Here's how it continues, verse 48. It says, as the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. And check out what it's clarifying here. It says, without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. And so what it's trying to overly communicate in this whole lesson is not about David's strength. This whole lesson isn't about, like, you know, David didn't win the battle because he was so good or because he just picked the right weapon and was excellent at it. The story is trying to say that, like, David won the battle because he trusted that God was with him and that God was still working under the surface of his situation to bring about his good and to bring further God's glory. David trusted that God was with him in the middle of the battle. And so in the face of trouble, David didn't declare how great he was. Instead, he looked up to heaven and he declared how great our God is. And so here's the second thing I want us to remember about bottom of the ninth moments is this, is that God can actually use those bottom of the ninth moments to display his power and love in your life. God can use those moments to display his power and love in your life. And so the key to victory in our bottom of the ninth moments is not about what you have or what you don't. It's about remembering who stands with you and who is fighting and working on your behalf. That's why Max Lucado once said that you can rush your giant with a God-saturated soul. You can rush your giant with a God-saturated soul because God is with you, because God is still working. Back in 1991, the Atlanta Braves, this is the year before their crazy Sid Bream play. They made this crazy run. They went from worst place to first place. And the Atlanta Braves were playing in the World Series for the first time like I could ever remember. And they were playing against the Minnesota Twins. And in this game, game four, the Braves were facing a bottom of the ninth moment. And the game was tied. And Bobby Cox looks down the bench and he pulls out this player named Francisco Cabrera. He pulls him out of the lineup and he sits him on the bench. Francisco Cabrera, the one who hit the game winner the next year. And he puts instead this pinch hitter named Jerry Willard. Now, Jerry Willard is a guy who's barely known. He'd not batted at all during the series. And so this huge moment, small underdog. Mark Lemke's on third base. We needed any kind of hit in the outfield and we would win the game. Here's what happens.
That's going to be a winner for Atlanta. The runner tags at third. Here's the throw from Matt. Here's Lemke. He is out. They call it safe. And Atlanta wins. And we're tied 2 games apiece.
You just enjoy this. So 1 year before the Braves had the Sid Bream play, this was a defining moment in the bottom of the ninth where Jerry Willard became the hero. And I believe that this was a springboard to the greatest run in all of Braves history, you know, where they won one world championship and like 18 division titles. And I tell you this because the point of this is when you face bottom of the ninth moments, you never know how God is going to use those moments to prepare you for even greater victories that are ahead. That you would never, ever, ever have if you didn't face the giants that you did in that season. And so I don't know why we face certain giants, but I want you to be reminded of this truth, is that no matter what you face, that God is still with you and God is still working, and he is working under the surface of your story to bring about your good and to bring up further his glory. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for this amazing truth, and we thank you that you love us so much that no matter what we face, that nothing's too big for you. That you love us so much that you're willing to stand with us. And we just want to declare that over whatever situation we might face today. God, I pray for those of us in here who know those giant situations in the bottom of the ninth. That maybe we're facing some right now. I just pray that you would remind us and you would help us to never forget what you told us in the light when we're sitting in the valley in the dark. And so God, I just pray that you would use those situations to show us your glory and to demonstrate your goodness in our life. And we ask this in Jesus' name.